what to say to this. I'm not sure if I ought to receive company when Mrs. Wells is out.
Mrs. Wells, said the man, and laughed. Sounds almost respectable when you put it like that.
He reached back and closed the door behind him.
Crosby's my name. What's yours?
Miss Anna Wetherill, said Anna with increasing alarm. He was already moving to the sideboard.
Care for a drop of something, Miss Anna Wetherill?
No, thank you. He picked up a bottle and tilted it at her.
No, because you don't have a taste for liquor, or no, because you're being polite?
I only just arrived.
You told me so once already, my girl. And anyway, that doesn't answer the question I asked.
I wouldn't want to take advantage of Mrs. Wells' hospitality, said Anna, with a slight emphasis of disapproval, as though to communicate that he ought not to either.
Crosby uncorked the bottle, sniffed, and recorked it.
Ah, there's no such thing as hospitality, he said, returning the bottle to the tray and selecting another. You'll be billed for everything you touch in this room, and quick as thieves, you mark my words.
No, Anna said, it's all been paid for, and Mrs. Wells has been wonderfully hospitable. I am staying at her personal request.
He was amused by this. Oh, yes. Nearest and dearest, are you? Old friends?
Anna frowned.
We met at the quay this afternoon.
Just by accident, I suppose.
Yes. There was a young woman, Miss Mackay, who didn't make the sailing. Her cousin's cousin. When Miss Mackay didn't show, Mrs. Wells invited me in place of her. The room and board is all paid in advance.
Oh,
said the man, pouring out a glass full of liquor.
Have you just returned from the fields? Said Anna, stalling for time.
I have, said the man. Up in the high country. Arrived back this morning.
He drank, expelled a breath, and then said,
Now, it's not right if I don't tell you. You've been euchred.
I've been what?
Euchred.
I don't know what that means, Mr. Crosby.
He smiled at her mistake, but did not correct her.
There's always a Miss Mackay, he explained. It's a line she spins. So you believe her, and you follow her home, and before you know it, you'll be olden, aren't you now? She's given you a fine meal and a hot bath and nothing but the milk of kindness.
And what have you given her?
Ah, he wagged his finger. But there will be something, Miss Anna Wetherill. There will be something that you can give.
He seemed to perceive Anna's anxiety, for he added in a gentler tone,
Here's something you ought to know. There's no charity in a gold town. If it looks like charity, look again.
Oh, said Anna.
He drained his glass and set it down.
Are you partial to a drink or not?
Not today, thank you.
He reached into his pocket, withdrew something, and then held up a closed fist.
Can you guess what I'm holding? He said.
No.
Go on, have a guess.
A coin?
Better than a coin. Guess again.
I can't think,
she said, in panic. He opened his fist to reveal a nugget of gold around the size and shape of a chestnut, laughed again at her expression, and then tossed it to her. She caught it in the heels of her hands.
That's enough in gold to buy every last bottle on this tray, with pounds left over, he said. It's yours, if you'll keep me company until the mistress comes back. How about it? You'll have a heads up on those debts when they start mounting.
I've never touched a piece of gold, Anna said,
turning it over. It was heavier than she had imagined it would be, and more elemental. It seemed to turn dull in her hands.
Come here, said Crosby.
He took the brandy bottle to the little sofa, sat down and patted the space beside him.
Share a drink with a fella, my girl. I've been walking for 2 weeks, and I'm thirsty as hell, and I want something nice to look at. Come here. I'll tell you everything you need to know about Mrs. Lydia Wells.
Crux, in which two verdicts are delivered, and the justice fits the sentence to the crime. Te Rau Taufare had not been invited to testify at either trial.
he had watched the day's proceedings from the rear of the courtroom, his expression somber, his back against the wall. When Justice Kemp called for a final recess, giving the order for all the day's witnesses to be remanded in custody, Taufare left the courthouse with the rest. Outside he saw the armoured carriage waiting to transport the felons back to the jail, and went to greet the duty sergeant who was standing by.
"Hello, Mr. Taufare," the sergeant said.
"Hello."
"How's your friend Staines doing, then? Kicking up his heels in there?"
"Yes," said Taufare.
"I popped my head in. Couldn't hear much. Good show, is it?"
"Very good," Taufare said.
"Gov Shepherd got a rap on the knuckles this morning, didn't he?"
"Yes."
"I would have liked to have seen that," the sergeant said.
Just then, the rear door of the courthouse opened and the bailiff appeared in the doorway.
"Drake," he called.
"Yes, sir,"
said the sergeant, standing tall.
"Justice wants Francis Carver escorted to Seaview," the bailiff said. "Special orders. You're to take him up the hill and then come straight back again."
Drake ran to open the doors of the carriage.
"Only Carver?"
"Only Carver," the bailiff said. "Mind you're back in time for the verdict. Straight up to Seaview and straight back again."
"Can do.
Quick about it. He's coming now."
Francis Carver was brought out into the yard and bundled into the carriage. His hands had been cuffed behind him. Inside the carriage, Drake produced a second set of cuffs from his belt and used these to cuff Carver's linked wrists to a clue that had been fixed to the wall behind the driver's seat.
"That's not going anywhere," he said cheerfully, rattling the clue to prove his point. "There's an inch of iron between you and the world, Mr. Carver. Hoo-hoo, what have you done that they don't trust you with all the rest? Last I checked, you were a bloody witness. Next minute, you're in irons."
Carver said nothing.
"1 hour,
the bailiff said, and returned inside. Drake jumped out of the carriage and closed the doors.
"Hi, Mr. Taufare," he said as he set the latch. "Care for a dash up the hill and back? You'll be down in time for the verdict."
Taufare hesitated.
"What do you say?" the sergeant said. "Beautiful day for a ride, and we'll pick up a bit of speed coming down."
Still Taufare hesitated. He was staring at the latch upon the carriage door.
"How about it?"
"No," Taufare said at last.
"Suit yourself," said Drake, shrugging.
He clambered up onto the driver's seat, picked up the reins, and urged the horses. The carriage rattled away.
"Mr. Emery Staines, you plead guilty to having falsified the records of the Aurora Gold Mine in order to avoid share payments owing to Mr. Francis Carver at a value of 50% net profit per annum, and to avoid a bonus payment owing to John Long Quee at an undisclosed value. You plead guilty to having embezzled a great quantity of raw gold found by John Long Quee upon the Aurora, which has since been valued at £4,096. You admit that you thieved this gold from the Aurora and buried it in the Arahura Valley with the purpose of concealment. You also plead guilty to dereliction, stating that you have been incapacitated for the past 2 months by excessive and prolonged consumption of opium."
The justice laid his papers aside and folded his hands together.
"Your counsel, Mr. Staines," he said, "has done a very good job of painting Mr. Carver in a poor light this afternoon. Notwithstanding his performance, however, the fact remains that provocation to break the law is not license to break the law. Your poor opinion of Mr. Carver does not give you the right to determine what he does or does not deserve. You did not witness the assault against Miss Wetherill firsthand, and nor, it seems, did anybody else. Therefore, you cannot know beyond a shadow of a doubt whether Mr. Carver truly was the author of that assault, or indeed, if an assault took place at all. Of course, the loss of any child is a tragedy, and tragedy cannot be mitigated by circumstance. But in adjudicating your crime, Mr. Staines, we must put aside the tragic nature of the event and consider it purely as a provocation, an indirect provocation, I should say, for your having committed the rather more cold-blooded crimes of embezzlement and fraud in retaliation.
Yes, you had provocation to dislike Mr. Carver, to resent Mr. Carver, even to despise him. But I feel that I state a very obvious point when I say that you might have brought your grievance to the attention of the Hokitika police and saved us all a great deal of bother. Your guilty plea does you credit. I also acknowledge that you have shown courtesy and humility in your responses this morning. All this suggests contrition and deference to the proper execution of the law. Your charges, however, show a selfish disregard for contractual obligation, a capricious and decadent temperament, and a dereliction of duty, not only to your claims, but to your fellow men. Your poor opinion of Mr. Carver, however justified that opinion might be, has led you to take the law into your own hands on more than one occasion, and in more than one respect. In light of this, I consider that it will do you a great deal of good to put away your grand philosophy for a time and learn to walk in another man's shoes. Mr. Carver has been a shareholder of the Aurora for 9 months. He has fulfilled his contractual obligation to you, and he has been ill-rewarded. Emery Staines, I hereby sentence you to 9 months' servitude with labour.
Staines' face betrayed nothing at all.
Yes, sir.
The justice turned to Anna.
Miss Anna Wetherill, he said, you have pleaded not guilty to all charges brought to bear against you, and in a civilized court we hold to the principle that one is innocent until proven guilty. I am sensible of the fact that aspersions cast by Mr. Moody upon Governor Shepherd are aspersions only. However, they have been duly recorded by this court and may be productive in the future, pending investigations made upon Governor Shepherd and others. In the meantime, I do not see that there is sufficient evidence to prove your guilt. You are acquitted of all charges. You shall be released from jail effective instant. I trust that from here you will continue on the righteous path to sobriety, chastity, and other virtues of a civilized kind. Needless to say that I never wish to see you in this courtroom again, on any charge, least of all a charge of public intoxication and disorderly behavior. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, sir.
Good.
He turned to the barrister's bench.
Now,
he said heavily, but before he got any further, there came the sound of shouting in the street, and a terrible crash, and the high whinny of panicked horses, and then a terrible thump on the courthouse door, as though someone had thrown their bodily weight against it.
What's going on? Said the justice, frowning.
Moody had started up. He heard shouting from the porch, and a great clatter.
Open the door, someone! See what's happening! The justice said.
The door was thrown open.
Sergeant Drake! Exclaimed the justice. What is it?
The sergeant's eyes were wild.
It's Carver, he cried. What about him? He's dead. What? Some point between here and Seaview. Someone must have opened the doors, and I never noticed. I was driving. I opened the doors to unload him, and there he was. And he's dead.
Moody whipped about, half expecting that Mrs. Carver might have fallen into a faint. But she had not. She was looking at Drake, white-faced. Quickly, Moody scanned the faces around her. All the witnesses had been remanded during the recess, including those who had testified in the morning. None of them had left the courthouse. Shepherd was there, and Lauderback, and Frost, and Lerventhal, and Clinch, and Mannering, and Quee, and Nielsen, and Pritchard, and Balfour, and Gascoigne, and Devlin. Who was missing?
"He's right outside," cried Drake, throwing out his arm. "His body! I came right back! I couldn't... It wasn't..."
The justice raised his voice above the commotion.
"He took his own life?" "Hardly," cried Drake, his voice cracking into a sob. "Hardly."
The crowd began crushing through the doors past him.
"Sergeant Drake," shouted the justice.
How in all heaven did Francis Carver die?
Drake was now lost in the crowd. His voice floated up.
Somebody bashed his head in.
The justice's face had turned purple.
Who?
He roared.
Who did it?
I'm telling you, I don't know.
There came a terrible shriek from the street, and then shouting. The courthouse emptied. Mrs. Carver, watching the last of the crowd fight its way through the doorway, brought her hands up to her mouth. Combust, in which Mrs. Wells receives a false impression, and Francis Carver relays important news. While Anna Wetherill entertained Mr. Crosby at the House of Many Wishes on Cumberland Street, Lydia Wells was doing some entertaining of her own. It was her habit in the afternoons to take her almanacs and star charts to the Hawthorne Hotel upon George Street, where she set up shop in a corner of the dining room and offered to tell the fortunes of diggers and travellers newly arrived. Her sole customer that afternoon had been a golden-haired boy in a felt cap, who, as it turned out, had also arrived on the steamer Fortunate Wind. He was a voluble subject, and seemed both delighted and fascinated by Mrs. Wells' affinity for the arcane. His enthusiasm was flattering, and inclined her to be generous with her prognostications. By the time his natal chart was drawn, his past and present canvassed, and his future foretold, it was coming on 4 o'clock. She looked up to see Francis Carver striding across the dining room towards her.
"Edward," she said to the golden-haired boy, "be a darling, would you, and ask the waiter to wrap up a pie with a hot water crust. Tell him to put it on my account. I'll take it home for my dinner."
The boy obliged. "I've just had some good news," said Carver, when the boy was gone.
"What is it?"
"Lauderback's on his way."
"Ah,"
said Lydia Wells.
"He must have seen the shipping receipt from Danforth at long last. I hear from Billy Bruce that he's bought his passage on the Active, sailing out of Akaroa. He arrives on the 12th of May, and he sends an advance message that Godspeed is not to depart until then."
3 weeks away.
"We've got him, Greenway. Like a fish in a trap, we've got him."
"Poor Mr. Lauderback,"
said Mrs. Wells vaguely.
"You might step over to the Naval Club this week and make an offer to the boys. A free night of craps, or double the jackpot, or a girl with every spin of the wheel. Something to tempt Raxworthy away from the ship that night, so that I can get a chance to get at Lauderback alone."
"I will go to the club in the morning," said Mrs. Wells.
She began to tidy her books and charts away.
"Poor Mr. Lauderback," she said again.
"He made his own bed," said Carver, watching her.
"Yes, he did, but you and I warmed the sheets for him."
"Don't feel sorry for a coward," said Carver. "Least of all a coward with money to spare."
"I pity him."
"Why? Because of the bastard? I'd sooner feel sorry for the bastard."
"Lauderback's had nothing but good luck from start to finish.
He's a made man."
"He is. And yet he is pitiable," said Mrs. Wells. "He's so ashamed, Francis, of Crosby, of his father, of himself. I cannot help but feel pity for a man who is ashamed."
"No chance of Wells turning up unexpectedly, is there?"
"You talk as if he and I were intimates," snapped Mrs. Wells. "I can't answer for him. I certainly can't control his every move."
"How long since he was last in town?"
"Months."
"Does he write before he comes home?"
"Good Lord," said Mrs. Wells. "No, he doesn't write."
"Is there any way you can make sure he keeps away? It wouldn't do for him to come face to face with Lauderback, not at the 11th hour."
"A drink will always tempt him, whatever the hour."
Carver grinned.
"Send him a mixed crate in the post? Set him up with a tally at the Diggers' Arms?"
"That, in fact, is a rather good idea."
She saw the boy coming back from the kitchens with the pie wrapped in paper and rose from the table.
"I must be getting back now. I shall call on you tomorrow."
"I'll be waiting," Carver said.
"Thank you, Edward."
said Mrs. Wells to the boy, taking the pie, and goodbye. I could wish good fortune upon you, but that would be a waste of a wish, would it not?
The boy laughed. Carver was smiling too. Did you tell his fortune, then?
Oh, yes, said Mrs. Wells. He is to become excessively rich.
Is he now? Like all the rest?
Not like all the rest, said Mrs. Wells. Exceptionally rich. Goodbye, Francis.
I'll be seeing you, said Carver.
Goodbye, Mrs. Wells, said the boy. She swept from the room, and the two men gazed after her.
When she was gone, Carver tilted his head at the boy. Your name's Edward?
Actually, no, it isn't, said the boy, looking a little shamefaced. I made the choice to travel incognito, as you might say. My father always told me, when it comes to whores and fortune-tellers, never give your real name.
Carver nodded. That's sense.
I don't know about the whores part, the boy went on. It grieves me to think of my father using them. I feel a kind of repugnance about it, out of loyalty to my mother, I suppose. But I like the telling fortunes part. It was rather a thrill to use another man's name. It made me feel invisible somehow, or doubled, as though I had split myself in two.
Carver glanced at him, and then after a moment put out his hand. Francis Carver's my name.
Emery Staines, said the boy.
Mercury sets, in which a stranger arrives upon the beach at Hokitika. The bonanza is apportioned, and Walter Moody quits the Crown Hotel at last. Even in his best suit, with his hair combed and oiled, his boots blackened and his handkerchief scented, Mr. Adrian Moody was a great deal less handsome than his younger son. His countenance bore the symptoms of a lifetime's dependence upon hard drink. His eyes were pouched, his nose swollen, and his complexion permanently flushed. And when he moved, it was without grace or fluidity. He walked in a stiff-hipped, lumbering fashion. His gaze was restless and wary. His hands, stained yellow with tobacco smoke, were always stealing into his pockets or picking in an anxious way at his lapels. Upon clambering out of the skiff that had conveyed him from the steamer to the beach, Moody Senior took a moment to stretch his back, shake out his aches and cramps, and pat his body down. He directed his luggage to a hotel on Camp Street, shook hands with the customs officer who was standing by, thanked the oarsmen gruffly for their service, and finally set off down Revel Street with his hands locked behind his back. He walked the length of the street, up one side and down the other, frowning into each window box he passed, scanning the faces in the street very closely and smiling at no one. By now the crowd that had gathered outside the courthouse had dispersed, and the armoured carriage containing Francis Carver's body had returned to sea view. The double doors were shut and locked. Moody Senior barely glanced at the building as he passed. At length he mounted the steps to the Hokitika post office, where, inside the building, he joined the queue to the postmaster's window. As he waited, he retrieved a piece of paper from his wallet and unfolded it one-handed against his breast.
"I want this to find a Mr. Walter Moody," he said, when he reached the front of the queue.
"Certainly," said the postmaster. "Know where he's staying?"
As he spoke, the bells in the Wesleyan chapel rang out 5 o'clock.
"All I know is that he's been in Hokitika these months past," said Moody Senior.
"In town or in the gorge?"
"In town."
"At a hotel? Or is he tenting?"
"I'd guess a hotel, but I couldn't tell you. Walter Moody is the name."
"Mate of yours, is he?"
"He's my son."
"I'll have a boy look into it, and charge you collect once we find him," said the postmaster, making a note of the name. "He'll have to put a shilling down as surety, but if we find him tomorrow, we'll likely reimburse you sixpence."
"That's fine."
"Would you prefer an envelope or a seal?"
"An envelope," said the other. "But hang a moment. I want to read it through one more time."
"Step aside, then, and come back when you're ready. I'm shutting the window in half an hour."
Adrian Moody did as he was bid. He smoothed the letter flat on the countertop and then pushed it with his finger closer to the light.
Hokitika, the 27th of April, 66. Walter, I beg you to read this letter to its very end and to reserve your judgment upon me until you've done so. From my postmark, you will have perceived that I am in Hokitika, as you are. I am to take my lodging at the Temperance Hotel on Camp Street, an address which will no doubt cause you some surprise. You have long known that I have the Epicurean temperament. Now I am also of a stoical cast. I have sworn that I will never take another drop of liquor in this life, and since this oath was made, it has not been broken. It is in the spirit of repentance that I set down a brief account of those true intentions that my enslavement to the drink has occluded, even perverted, in recent years. I left the British Isles on account of debt, and debt alone. Frederick, your brother, had an acquaintance upon the field at Lawrence in Otago, and by his report the prospects there seemed very good. Frederick had determined to join him. You were in Rome, and meant to winter on the continent. I decided to make the journey in secret, in the hope that I would return as a rich man before the year was out. I confess, this was a decision made with shameful provocation, for there were several men in London and also in Liverpool, whom I desired very much to escape. Before I left, I portioned a sum of £20 for my wife, the very last of my savings. Much later, I learned that this provision never reached its destination. It was stolen, and by the very man who was to be its bearer, the blackguard Piers Howland, may he live in shame and die in squalor. By the time I discovered this, I was in Otago, half a world away. Furthermore, I could not make contact without risking pursuit, even conviction, on account of crimes unpunished and debts unpaid. I did nothing. I counted my wife as abandoned, prayed that God would forgive me, and continued with Frederick on the fields. We made only pay dirt during our first year in Otago. I have heard it said that the men of the comfortable classes have the worst of luck upon the diggings, for they cannot bear privation as the lower orders can. This was certainly true in our case. We struggled mightily, and despaired often. But we persevered, and 7 months ago your brother struck upon a nugget the size of a snuff-box, caught between two boulders in the elbow of a stream. It was upon this nugget that we were able to begin to build our fortunes at long last. You might ask why we did not send this nugget home with our apologies and blessings. That question would be a good one. Frederick, your brother, had long been in favour of writing to you. He had urged me to make contact with my abandoned wife, and even to invite her to join us here. But I resisted. I resisted also his intimations that I should quit the devil drink and mend my ways. We had many arguments along this theme, and finally parted on less than civil terms. I am sorry to say that I do not know where Frederick is now. You have always been the scholar of the family, Walter. I am ashamed of a great many aspects of my life, but I've never been ashamed of you. In taking my oath of temperance, I have confronted my true soul. I have seen myself truly as a man of weakness and of cowardice, easy prey to vice and sin of all description. But if I am proud of one thing, it is that my sons are not like me in these degenerate respects. It is a painful joy for a father to save his son,
That man is a better man than I. I assure you, I have felt this painful joy twice over. I can do no more than to beg for your forgiveness, as I must also beg for Frederick's, and to promise that our next reunion, should you grant me one, will be conducted dry. Good fortune, Walter. Know that I have confronted my true soul, and that I write this as a sober man. Know also that even the briefest reply would greatly cheer the heart of your father, Adrian Moody.
He read the letter twice over, then folded it into the envelope and wrote his son's name in large letters upon the front. His hand trembled as he capped his pen.
A Mr. Frost for Mr. Staines.
Send him in, said Devlin. Charlie Frost had a piece of paper in his hand.
Expenses, he said, looking apologetic.
Have a seat, said Devlin.
What's the damage, Mr. Frost? Said Staines.
He was looking very tired.
Extensive, I'm afraid, said Frost, drawing up a chair. Justice Kemp has ruled that Francis Carver's dividend of £2,048 must be honoured. There's a catch. The Garrity Group is to be repaid in full for the claim taken out against Godspeed, but the rest will go to Mrs. Carver as Carver's widow.
How is she? Devlin said.
Sedated, said Frost. Dr. Gillies and Mr. Pritchard are waiting on her, I believe. Last I saw her, she was being escorted back to the Wayfarer's fortune.
He turned back to Staines, flattening his paper on the desk.
May I itemise the expenses briefly?
Yes.
As the party found guilty, you are responsible for all legal fees, including those incurred by Mr. Fellows these months past, and including also Mr. Nielsen's commission, since invested in the Seaview jailhouse. As you might remember, the magistrate ruled that because it had been charitably donated, it would not be revoked. In total, all of this amounts to a little over £500.
Halved and halved again, said Staines.
Yes, I'm afraid you will find that a common theme with legal expenses. There's more. You've also been sued for damages by a great many diggers in both Kenyeri and the Hokitika Gorge. I don't have the exact sum for you yet, but I'm afraid it's likely to be dozens of pounds, perhaps hundreds.
Is that everything?
In terms of official expenses, yes, said Frost. There are several unofficial matters to discuss, however. Do we have time?
Do we have time? Said Staines to Devlin.
We have until the carriage gets here, said Devlin.
I will be quick, said Frost. As you may be aware, the gold extracted from Anna's orange gown is still stowed beneath Mr. Gascoigne's bed. Anna owes a debt of some £120 to Mr. Mannering, and she had thought to repay this amount with the pure colour extracted from the orange gown. I had the idea, however, that you might like to take on her debt to Mr. Mannering, and arrange for Mr. Mannering to be repaid out of your share of the bonanza as an itemised expense. That way Anna will have something to live on, you see, during the months where you're in jail.
Good, said Staines.
Yes, do that. Just as you say.
Frost made a note of this.
The second matter, he said, is the bonus owing to Mr. Quee. We must keep up the sham that the fortune originated on the Aurora, you see, and every man who comes upon a bonanza deserves a reward.
Of course, said Staines. A bonus.
I'm given to understand, Frost continued, that Mr. Quee is desirous to return to China once his company indenture expires. Furthermore, he wishes to return with exactly 768 shillings in his pocket. According to Mr. Mannering, he has long set his mind upon this precise figure. I believe it is of some personal, spiritual significance to him.
Ordinarily, this curiosity would have tickled Emery Staines extremely, but he did not smile. It was Devlin who exclaimed, 768 shillings?
Yes,
said Frost.
What a fastidious thing, said Devlin. What does it augur, do you know?
I'm afraid I do not, said Frost. But if I might make a suggestion,
turning back to Staines,
Perhaps your bonus payment to Mr. Quee ought to be enough to realise this ambition.
What does it come to in pounds?
£38.08, said Frost. Roughly 1% of 4,000, and 1% is a reasonable rate for a Goldfields bonus, especially given that Mr. Quee is Chinese. As a gesture of good faith, you also might wish to consider buying him out of his indenture and facilitating his passage home.
Stane shook his head.
I never thought of him, did I?
Who? Said Frost.
Mr. Quee, said Staines. I simply never thought of him. Well, he did us all a very great favour this afternoon in keeping our secret, and now we have a chance to do him one in return. I have spoken to Mr. Mannering already. He is content to accept an early termination of Mr. Quee's contract, and has costed it at my request. If you pay Mr. Quee a bonus of £64, then all expenses should be adequately covered.
Staines brought his shoulder up to his cheek and sighed.
Yes, he said. All right. Now, the third financial matter.
Frost coughed slightly.
When we first came upon the fortune back in January, Mr. Clinch made me a present of £30 as a gift. I'm afraid I spent it, and I have not the means to repay even a penny of it. I wonder if I might impose upon your generosity and list those £30 as bank expenses?
He said all this very fast, and then added,
There's a loan, of course. I'd repay it by the time of your release.
Here's the carriage, Devlin said, rising.
That's fine, said Staines to Frost. Pay it out. Just as you say, it doesn't matter.
Frost exhaled, full of relief.
Thank you very much, Mr. Staines.
He watched as Devlin escorted Staines from the cell. When they reached the doorway, he said, raising his voice a little,
First thing tomorrow, I'll send you up an itemized receipt.
The chapel bells were ringing out 7 o'clock as Walter Moody folded the last of his fine clothes into his trunk, closed the lid, and secured the hasp. Rising, he checked the flies of his yellow moleskin trousers, tightened his belt, touched the red kerchief that was knotted about his neck, and finally reached for his coat and hat, the former a plain woolen garment cut almost to his knees, and the latter a heavy, soft-crowned thing with a wide, waxed brim. He donned both, slung his swag onto his back, and left the room, removing the key from the lock as he did so. During his absence, his trunk was to be kept at Clark's warehouse on Gibson Quay, to which place his private mail, if he received any, would also be directed. To finance this relocation, he left 3 silver shillings at the Crown front desk, along with his key. He slipped a 4th shilling into the hand of the Crown maid, folding her small yellow hand in both his own, and thanked her very warmly for the 3 months' service and hospitality she had provided him. Quitting the Crown, he turned down the narrow path that led to the beachfront, and at once began walking north, his swag clanking on his back, his tent roll bumping the backs of his legs with each step. He was no more than 2 miles out of Hokitika when he perceived that he was walking some 10 paces ahead of another man, similarly clad in the digger's habitual costume. Moody glanced back, and they acknowledged one another with a nod.
"Hi there," said the other. "You walking north?"
"I am."
"Heading for the beaches, are you? Charleston way?"
"So I hope. Do we share a destination?"
"Seems we do," the other said. "Mind if I fall into step?"
"Not at all," said Moody. "I shall be glad of the company. Walter Moody is my name. Walter."
"Paddy Ryan," said the other. "You got a Scottish tongue on you, Walter Moody."
"I cannot deny it," said Moody.
"Never had any trouble with a Scot."
"And I have never quarrelled with an Irishman."
"That makes one of you," said Paddy Ryan with a grin. "But it's the truth. I never had any trouble with a Scot."
"I am very glad of it."
They walked on in silence for a time.
"I guess we're both a long way away from home," said Paddy Ryan presently.
"I'm a long way from where I was born," said Moody, squinting across the breakers to the open sea.
"Well," said Paddy Ryan, "if home can't be where you come from, then home is what you make of where you go.
That is a good motto, Moody said. Paddy Ryan nodded, seeming pleased.
Are you fixing to stay in this country then, Walter? After you've dug yourself a patch and made yourself a pile?
I expect my luck will decide that question for me.
Would you call it lucky to stay or lucky to go?
I'd call it lucky to choose, said Moody, surprising himself, for that was not the answer he would have given 3 months prior. Paddy Ryan looked at him sidelong.
How about we share our stories? Make the road a little shorter that way.
Our stories? Do you mean our histories?
Aye, or the stories you've heard, or whatever you like.
All right, said Moody a little stiffly. Do you want to go first, or shall I?
You go first, said Paddy Ryan. Give us a tale and spin it out, so we forget about our feet and we don't notice that we're walking.
Moody was silent for a time, wondering how to begin. I am trying to decide between the whole truth and nothing but the truth, he said presently. I'm afraid my history is such that I can't manage both at once.
Hoy, no need for the truth at all, said Paddy Ryan. Who said anything about the truth? You're a free man in this country, Walter Moody. You tell me any old rubbish you like, and if you string it out until we reach the junction at Coomara, then I shall count it as a very fine tale.
Sun and moon in conjunction. New moon. In which Mrs. Wells makes two very interesting discoveries. When Lydia Wells returned to the House of Many Wishes a little after 7 o'clock, she was informed by the maid that Anna Wetherill had received a caller in her absence. Mr. Crosby Wells, who had returned unexpectedly after many months of absence in the Otago Highlands. Mr. Wells had an appointment of some kind upon George Street that evening, the maid reported, but he had left with the assurance that he would return the next morning in the hope of securing an interview with his wife. Mrs. Wells received this news thoughtfully.
How long did you say he stayed, Lucy?
2 hours, ma'am.
From when until when?
3 until 5.
And Miss Wetherill?
I haven't disturbed her, said Lucy. She hasn't rung the bell since he left, and I didn't trouble them when he was here.
Good girl, said Mrs. Wells. Now, if Crosby does come back tomorrow, and if for whatever reason I'm not here, you show him to Miss Wetherill's room as before.
Yes, ma'am.
And you'd better put in an order at the wine and spirit merchant first thing tomorrow. A mixed crate should do us fine.
Yes, ma'am.
Here's a pie for our supper. See that it's heated through and then send it up. We'll eat at 8, I think.
Very good, ma'am.
Lydia Wells arranged her almanacs and star charts in her arms, peered critically into the glass hanging in the hall, and then ascended the stairs to Anna's room, where she knocked briskly and opened the door without waiting for an answer.
Is it not better to be fed and dry and clean? She said, in lieu of a greeting.
Anna had been sitting in the window box. She leapt up when Mrs. Wells strode into the room, blushing deeply, and said,
Very much better, ma'am. You are much too kind.
There is no such thing as too much kindness, declared Mrs. Wells, depositing her books upon the table next to the settee. She glanced quickly at the sideboard, making a mental tally of the bottles, and then turned back to Anna and smiled.
What fun we shall have this evening! I'm going to draw your chart.
Anna nodded. Her face was still very red.
I draw a chart each time I make a new acquaintance, Mrs. Wells went on. We shall have a glorious good time, finding out what is in store for you. And I have brought home a pie for our supper, the best that can be had in all Dunedin. Isn't that fine?
Very fine,
said Anna, dropping her gaze to the floor. Mrs. Wells seemed not to notice her discomfort.
Now,
she said, sitting down at the settee and drawing the largest book towards her.
What is the date of your birthday, my dear?
Anna told her. Mrs. Wells drew back. She placed her hand over her heart.
No,
she said.
What? How terribly odd.
What's odd?
said Anna, looking frightened. You have the same birthday as a young man. I just...
Lydia Wells trailed off and then said, suddenly,
How old are you, Miss Wetherill?
21.
21? And you were born in Sydney?
Yes, ma'am.
Right in town?
Yes.
Lydia Wells' expression was marvellous.
You don't happen to know the precise hour of your birth, do you?
I believe I was born at night, said Anna, blushing again. That's the way my mother tells it, but I don't know the precise hour.
It is astonishing, cried Mrs. Wells. I am astonished. The exact same birthday, perhaps even beneath the very same sky.
I don't understand, said Anna.
In a hushed tone of conspiracy, Lydia Wells explained. She spent her afternoons at a hotel upon George Street, where she gave astral predictions for a small fee. Her customers, for the most part, were young men about to make their fortunes on the goldfield. That afternoon, while Anna was enjoying her bath, she had given a reading to just such a man. The querent, so she described him, was also 21, and had also been born in Sydney upon the very same day as Anna. Anna could not make sense of Mrs. Wells' exhilaration.
What does it mean? She said.
What does it mean?
Lydia Wells' voice dropped to a whisper.
It means that you may share a destiny, Miss Wetherill, with another soul.
Oh,
Anna said.
You may have an astral soulmate whose path through life perfectly mirrors your own.
Anna was not as impressed by this as Mrs. Wells might have hoped.
Oh,
she said again.
The phenomenon is very rare, said Mrs. Wells.
But I had a cousin with the same birthday as me, Anna said, and we can't have shared a destiny because he died.
It is not enough to share a day, said Mrs. Wells. You must be born at the exact same minute and at the exact same latitude and longitude. That is, under the exact same sky. Only then will your charts be identical. Even twins, you see, are born some minutes apart, and in the interim the skies have shifted a little and the patterns have changed.
I don't know the exact minute I was born, Anna said, frowning.
Nor did he, said Mrs. Wells, but I shall lay my money upon the fact that your charts are identical, for we know already that the two of you have something in common.
What?
Me, said Mrs. Wells triumphantly. On the 27th of April, 1865, you both arrived in Dunedin, and you both had your natal charts drawn by Mrs. Crosby Wells.
Anna brought her hand up to her throat.
What? She whispered. Mrs. What?
Lydia Wells continued with the same enthusiasm.
And there are other correspondences. He was travelling alone, as you were, and he arrived this morning, as you did. Perhaps he made a friend by some accident of circumstances, quite as you did when you met me.
Anna was looking as though she might be sick.
Edward is his name. Edward Sullivan. Oh, how I wish I had brought him back with me. How I wish I had known. Are you not aching to make his acquaintance?
Yes, ma'am, she whispered.
What an extraordinary thing, said Lydia Wells, gazing at her. It is most extraordinary. I wonder what would happen were you ever to meet.
Part 5. Waite and Lucre. The 12th of May, 1865. 45 degrees 52 minutes south, 170 degrees 30 minutes east, Dunedin. Silver, in which Crosby Wells makes a request. Lydia Wells is imprudent, and Anna Wetherill plays witness to a rather ugly scene. The mortification that Anna Wetherill had suffered upon discovering that the man whom she had entertained upon the afternoon of her arrival in Dunedin had been, in fact, the master of the house, only intensified over the weeks that followed. Crosby Wells was now installed in the rear bedroom of No. 35 Cumberland Street, and, as a consequence, they saw each other every day. Anna Wetherill was painfully and perpetually conscious of the impression she created, and as a consequence of this abiding self-consciousness, her self-regard was critical to the point of fantasy. She had the inconsolable sense that there was something visible about her own character that she herself could not see,
and this anxiety could not be appeased by persuasion, proof, or compliment. She was certain, when in conversation, that the unvoiced conclusions formed by those around her were both censorious and wholly apt. And because the shame she felt at this imagined censure was very real, she sought all the harder to court the good opinion of those whom she met, feeling as she did so that even in this project her intentions were all too visible. Believing herself uniformly criticised, Anna would have been very surprised to learn that the impressions others formed of her were not uniform in the slightest. The artless simplicity with which she most often spoke indicated to some that she possessed an alarming store of private opinions, the frank expression of which was even more alarmingly unfeminine. To others, her speech was entirely without artifice, and refreshing for that reason. Likewise, her tendency to squint upon the world was suggestive to some of fearfulness, and to others of calculation. To Crosby Wells, she was merely and very simply sweet. He found her frequent embarrassments very amusing, and had told her so more than once.
"You'd do well in a camp, my girl," he said. "A breath of fresh air is what you are. Unspoiled. Nothing worse than a woman with a ready answer. Nothing worse than a woman who's forgotten how to blush."
Lydia Wells, a woman with a great many ready answers and who very rarely blushed, had been only infrequently seen at No. 35 Cumberland Street since her husband's unexpected return. She left the house in the late morning, and often did not return until the dusk, when the gambling parlour opened for the night. Wells, in her absence, kept mostly to the first-floor boudoir, where the decanters on the sideboard were refilled daily. Drink softened him. Anna found that she liked him best in the late afternoons, when three or four glasses of whisky had turned him pensive, but not yet sad. Wells, it transpired, had no desire to return to the fields at Dunstan. Anna learned that he had made a strike of significant value the previous year, and he now desired to put that fortune to some use. He was considering various investments, both in Dunedin and beyond, and he spent a great deal of time poring over the local papers, comparing prices for gold and tracking the rise and fall of various stocks.
"Would you fancy me better as a flock master or as a timber man, Miss Wetherall?" he said,
and then laughed very freely at her rising blush. Whether Mrs. Wells comprehended Anna's embarrassment, or the reason for it, Anna did not know. The older woman was no less warm, and her speech no less conspiratorial, than at the scene of their first meeting. But it seemed to Anna that her manner had acquired a glaze of distance, as though she were steeling herself, privately, for an impending breach in their relations. With her husband she was similarly removed. Whenever Wells spoke, she simply gazed at him, unsmiling, and then turned the conversation to an unrelated theme. Anna was devastated by these subtle tokens of displeasure, and as a consequence, she strove to secure her mistress's good opinion all the more. By now she knew very well that she had been, as Crosby Wells had phrased it, euchred. But any energy that she might have expended in confronting her mistress on the matter of the fictitious Elizabeth Mackay, who was never again mentioned, had been directed instead into a disgusted self-admonishment and a belief, privately held, that she alone could make restitution for what she and Crosby Wells had done. The operations of the House of Many Wishes had been revealed to Anna gently and in degrees. The morning after her arrival in Dunedin, Mrs. Wells had showed her the downstairs parlour, and Anna had loved it at once. The velvet booths, the green glass bottles behind the bar, the card tables, the gambling wheel, the small confessional with the saloon-style doors where Mrs. Wells occasionally told fortunes for a fee. In the daylight, the room seemed somehow preserved. The motes of dust, trapped in the shafts of light that fell through the high windows, had a patient, potent feel. Anna was quite awed. At her mistress's invitation, she stepped onto the podium and spun the gambling wheel. Watching the rubber needle clack, clack, clack towards the jackpot, only to fall with a final clack past it. Mrs. Wells did not invite her to attend the evening parties at once. From her bedroom window, Anna watched the men arrive,
stepping down from carriages, removing their gloves, striding up the walk to rap upon the door. Soon afterwards, cigar smoke began to seep through the floorboards into her room, lending a spicy, acrid tint to the air and turning the lamplight grey. By 9, the hum of conversation had thickened to a hubbub, punctuated by snatches of laughter and applause. Anna could hear only what came up through the floor, though every time someone opened the door to the downstairs passage, the noise intensified, and she could make out individual voices. Her curiosity was roused to the point of disconsolation, and after several days she inquired of Mrs. Wells, very tentatively and with much apology, whether she might be permitted to tend bar. She now did so every night, though Mrs. Wells had imposed 2 regulations. None of the patrons was to address her directly, and she was not permitted to dance.
"She's raising your value," Wells explained. "The longer they have to wait, the more you'll fetch when it comes time to go to market."
"Oh, Crosby," snapped Mrs. Wells. "Nobody's going to market. Don't be absurd."
"Farming," said Wells. "There's an enterprise. I could be a farmer, and you could be me farmer wife."
To Anna, he said,
"It's quite all right. My old ma was a whore, God rest her."
"He's only trying to frighten you," said Mrs. Wells. "Don't listen to him." "I'm not frightened," said Anna.
"She's not frightened," said Wells.
"There's nothing to be frightened about," said Mrs. Wells.
In fact, Anna thought the dancing girls quite marvellous. They were incurious about her, calling her either Sydney or Port Jackson if they addressed her at all, but she did not possess pride enough to be offended. In any case, their air of weary indifference was a sophistication to which she privately aspired. They brought up the drinks orders from the gentlemen playing cards and waited as Anna set out the glasses and poured. "A dash and a splash," they said, "for whiskey and water, and a hard dash for whiskey poured neat." When the drinks were poured, they slid the tray onto their hip, or hoisted it high above their heads, and sashayed back through the crowd, leaving behind them the powdery, sickly scent of grease paint and perfume. On the 12th of May, the inhabitants of No. 35 Cumberland Street rose early. The House of Many Wishes was to host a party that evening in honour of naval officers and gentlemen with marine connections, and there was much to be done in preparation for this grand event. Mrs. Wells had hired a fiddler and put in an order at the store for lemons, spruce liquor, rum, and several hundred yards of rope, which she planned to cut into lengths and plait so as to adorn each table with a knotted wreath as a centrepiece.
"I shall make the first wreath as a template," she said to Anna, "and you can do the rest this afternoon. I will guide you through the steps and show you how to tuck the ends away."
"Waste of a good manila line," said Wells.
Mrs. Wells continued as if he had not spoken.
"The wreaths look quite arresting, I think. One can never over-decorate at a themed event. If there is any rope left over, we can pin it up behind the bar."
They were eating breakfast together, an infrequent occasion, for it was rare that Wells rose before noon, and Mrs. Wells had usually quit the place by the time Anna woke. Mrs. Wells seemed nervous. Perhaps she was fearful for the success of the party.
"They will look marvellous," Anna said.
"What's next?" said Wells, who was out of humour. "A party for the diggers, with a riffle box on each table and a tail race from the bar? In honour of the common man, you could say. A party for the unremarkable man. Gentlemen with no connections whatsoever. There's a theme."
"Have you had enough toast, Anna?" said Mrs. Wells.
"Yes, ma'am," said Anna.
"One of tonight's guests is a decorated man,"
Mrs. Wells went on, changing the subject.
"How about that? I think it will be the first time that I've played hostess to a naval hero. We shall have to ask him all about it, shan't we, Anna?"
"Yes," said Anna.
"Captain Raxworthy is his name. He has a Victoria Cross. I do hope he wears it. Pass the butter, please."
Wells passed the butter. After a moment, he said,
"Have you today's witness?"
"Yes, I read it already. There was nothing of consequence to report,"
said Mrs. Wells.
"Friday papers are always light on the news."
"Where is it?" said Wells. "The paper."
"Oh, I burned it," said Mrs. Wells.
Wells stared at her.
"It's still morning," he said.
I'm quite aware that it is still the morning, Crosby, she said, giving a little laugh. I used it to light the fire in my bedroom, that's all.
It's 9 o'clock, Wells complained. You don't burn today's paper at 9 o'clock. Not when I haven't even seen it yet. I'll have to go out and buy another.
Save your sixpence, said Mrs. Wells. It was nothing but gossip. Nothing to report, I've told you.
She glanced at the carriage clock. The second time she'd done so in as many minutes, Anna observed.
I like a bit of gossip, said Wells. Anyway, you know that I'm looking at making an investment. How am I supposed to keep up with the stocks without the paper?
Yes, well, it's done now, and it won't hurt you to wait until tomorrow. Have you had enough toast, Anna?
Anna frowned slightly. Mrs. Wells had asked her this already.
Yes, ma'am.
Good, said Mrs. Wells. She was tapping her foot.
What fun we shall have tonight. I love to look forward to a party. And naval men are so high-spirited and terribly good storytellers. Their stories are never dull.
Wells was sulking. You know I spend my mornings with the paper. I do it every day.
You can catch up on The Leader, said Mrs. Wells. Or last week's Littleton Times. It's on my writing desk.
Why didn't you burn that, then?
Oh, I don't know, Crosby, snapped Mrs. Wells. I'm sure it won't do you any harm to occupy yourself in some other way. Read a settler's pamphlet. I have a store of them on the bureau downstairs.
Wells drained his coffee and set his cup down with a clatter.
I need the key to the safe, he announced.
It seemed to Anna that Mrs. Wells stiffened slightly. She did not look at her husband, but concentrated on buttering her toast. After a moment, she said,
Why is that?
What do you mean, why? I want to look at my dust.
We had agreed to wait until a more prudent time to sell, said Mrs. Wells.
I'm not selling anything. I just want to take stock of my affairs, that's all. Go through my papers.
I'd hardly call them papers, said Mrs. Wells, laughing slightly.
What else?
Oh, you make it sound so grand, that's all.
My miner's right. That's a paper.
What need could you possibly have for your miner's right?
He was scowling.
What is this? A royal inquisition?
Of course not.
It's what they are, said Wells. Papers. And there's a letter in there I'd like to read over.
Oh, come, said Mrs. Wells. You must have read that thing 1,000 times, Crosby. Even I know its every phrasing by heart. Dear boy, you do not know me.
Wells brought his fist down on the table, causing all of the crockery to jump.
Shut your mouth, he said.
Crosby,
said Mrs. Wells in shock.
There's sport and then there's sporting, said Wells. You just crossed over.
For a moment, it seemed as though Mrs. Wells were about to make a retort, but she thought better of it. She dabbed her mouth with a napkin, regaining composure.
Forgive me, she said.
Forgiveness doesn't cut it. I want the key.
She tried to laugh again.
Really, Crosby, today's not the day. Not with the naval party this evening and so much to organise. Let us put it off until tomorrow. We can sit down together, you and me.
I'm not putting it off until tomorrow, said Wells. Give me the key.
She rose from the table.
I'm afraid you've heard my final word on the matter, she said. Excuse me.
Excuse me? I'm afraid you haven't heard mine, said Wells.
He pushed his chair back from the table and rose also.
Where is it? On your necklace?
She edged around the table away from him.
In actual fact, it is in a safe box at the bank, she said. I don't keep a copy at home. If you wait, just a...
Rot, said Wells. It's on your necklace.
She took another step away from him, seeming for the first time alarmed.
Please, Crosby, don't cause a scene.
He advanced upon her.
Give it.
She tried to smile, but her mouth trembled.
Crosby, she said again, be reasonable. We have...
Give it to me.
You are causing a scene.
I'll cause a bigger scene than this. Give it up.
She tried to make for the door, but he was too fast. His hand shot out and grabbed her. She twisted her body away, and for a moment they struggled, and then Wells, scrabbling with one hand at her bodice, found what he was looking for. A thin silver chain, from which a fat silver key was dangling. He wrenched it out, gathering the key in his fist, and tried to snap the chain. It tore at her neck and would not break. She cried out. He tried again, more sharply. She was beating his chest with her fists. Grunting, he fought to restrain her, still with the chain wrapped round his fist. He tore at her neck again. "Crosby!" she gasped. "Crosby!" At last it broke, and the key was in his hand. She gave a sob. At once he turned, panting slightly, and went to the safe. He fitted the key into the lock, rattling the handle several times before the mechanism clicked, and then the heavy door swung open. The safe was empty.
"Where's my money?" said Crosby Wells.
Mrs. Wells swayed, her hands cupped around her neck. Her eyes were filled with tears.
"If you calm down just a moment," she said, "I can explain."
"Who needs calming?" said Wells. "I asked a simple question, that's all. Where's my bonanza?"
"Now, Crosby, listen," said Mrs. Wells. "I can get it back, the bonanza. I only put it away for a while, somewhere safe. I can get it back for you, but not until tomorrow, all right? Tonight there are a great many distinguished gentlemen coming to the house, and I haven't the time to go to where I've hidden it. There's just too much to do."
"Where are my papers?" said Wells. "My miner's right, my birth certificate, the letter from my father."
"They're with the bonanza."
"Are they now? And where is that?"
"I can't tell you."
"Why not, Mrs. Wells?"
"It's complicated," she said.
"I would imagine it is."
"I can get them back for you."
"Can you?"
"Tomorrow, after the party."
"Why not today? Why not this morning?"
"You can stop hectoring me," she said, flaring up. "I simply can't manage it today. You'll have to wait until tomorrow."
"You're asking for time," said Wells. "I wonder why."
"Crosby, the party," she said.
Wells looked at her for a long moment. Then he crossed the room and pulled sharply upon the bell rope. The maid Lucy appeared within moments.
"Lucy," said Wells, "go down onto George Street and pick me up a copy of today's Otago Witness. Mrs. Wells appears to have burned our copy by mistake."
Gold, in which Francis Carver receives a message and Staines is left alone.